You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, August 14th, 2013, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, everybody.
Hey, where's Bob?
Bob is apparently busy with work. Occasionally, he has to work through the night on what he calls a deploy. I guess they're getting a software package out there, and he's got to be available to do it.
That CIA terminology is very complex.
Yeah. I'm sure it's code for something nefarious. And we just couldn't move the record day this week. We were just locked in, so.
To substitute for Bob, we're going to have my son Dylan. Now, hold on. I'll turn on his baby monitor so he can join us. Can you hear that? All right, he's very skeptical about many things.
And just about as concise as Bob.
Exactly.
And more coherent.
And he doesn't talk as long.
Hey, happy birthday to Hazel Gladys Bishop.
Hazel.
Born at August 17th, 1906. Have you guys ever heard of Hazel Bishop?
Not until tonight.
Yeah.
No. Never. Neither had I.
Neither has
Bishop,
anyone.
Bishop was a chemist, and she started her career working for oil companies. She actually, apparently, she helped discover the cause of, and I'm quoting here, deposits affecting superchargers of aircraft engines during World War II. But after World War II, she decided to go into the cosmetics industry. In her kitchen, which she refitted as a lab, she developed the world's first long-lasting lipstick. She found the formula for a lipstick that would actually dye your lips the color that you wanted instead of just smearing stuff on top of them.
How long is long-lasting?
Well, just the kind that doesn't immediately wipe off on glasses and men's collars, things like that.
So that was apparently a problem with the original lipstick formula, right? It just wore off very quickly?
Yeah, and some lipsticks today, too. There's differences in different lipsticks. But and she said at the time that she was partially inspired by the fact that at the time, women were entering the workforce in droves, and she thought that it would be important for them to not have to constantly have to worry about reapplying their lipstick throughout the day when they're at the office or the factory or wherever they might be. So yeah, that's why she did it. And it sold for $1 a tube. And her company did extremely well. Unfortunately, she was forced out of her own company just a couple of years later. And luckily, though, she went on to do a bunch of other cool stuff. She was obviously super smart and very adaptable. And so from there, she became a financial analyst for companies who are interested in cosmetics and pharmaceuticals.
Oh, she's multi-talented.
Yeah. And then later, in 1978, she left Wall Street and she took a job teaching at the Fashion Institute of Technology in New York, where she taught about chemistry and cosmetology.
Wow.
And where Nexus is held, at least this year, probably next year. Yeah,
that's right.
She sounds awesome.
She was pretty awesome.
Rebecca, I understand your soft spot for successful scientific women, but you did pass over a lot of really cool stuff for August 17th.
Such as?
Here we go.
You want me to list some things?
Yeah,
it's also the birthday of Thomas Hodgkin, who discovered Hodgkin's lymphoma, a cancer.
Yeah, but if he didn't discover it, then nobody would have it today, so I think he's a jerk.
Pierre de Fermat, Fermat's last theorem? Come on.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of probing and space exploration going on.
Also, Paul Kammerer, who I was considering talking about because he is one of the guys who claimed to have scientific evidence to prove Lamarckian inheritance. The reason why I didn't choose it as the main item is because it's kind of depressing. He was accused of dummying his results, and he later got depressed and shot himself. So
yikes.
Wow. That is depressing. All right. Well, Jay, apparently there was a study recently which has explained once and for all near-death experiences.
Oh, come on. I wouldn't say once and for all. This would probably be
one of the phenomenally
early studies that would encourage a lot of other studies to be done, and maybe 20 or 30 years from now we'll have a much clearer idea. But the study was pretty cool. It was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Researchers have investigated the state of the brain during the dying process. It's a common belief that when we're about to die, our brains aren't functioning or at best operating at what has been called a significantly diminished level, right? So you see someone dying, you know, maybe they're bleeding out or having a heart attack or whatever. You don't expect their brain to be working in overdrive in any way or at peak performance. And all these stories about near-death experiences are part of the background noise that we all hear. And I'm sure most of you guys have heard about these stories as well. I actually know two people who had them. Approximately 20% of cardiac arrest survivors report having a near-death experience during what they call clinical death, which means that they weren't actually dead, but you know their heart wasn't beating.
They were mostly dead.
Yeah.
I got better.
And a lot of these near-death experiences are described by those who experience them as hyper-real or super intense, you know, vivid colors. Everything seems to be much more present than normal reality. So researchers at the University of Michigan wanted to learn more about this phenomenon, so they conducted experiments with 9 rats as they were dying, or as they weren't really dying. They were, I think from what
cardiac arrest.
They were giving them cardiac arrest, probably through chemical means. More specifically, though, they analyzed the 30-second period after the animal's heart stopped beating. And their reasoning was that if near-death experiences are the result of brain activity, which I can't see any other reason where near-death experiences would be coming from, then the brain activity can be measured, right? So if the brain is doing something, they can measure it somehow. They have to find out what's happening. And what they found was pretty fascinating. The researchers recorded and analyzed the rat's brain activity through an EEG, through an electroencephalogram. And there was a sharp increase in high-frequency brain waves that are called gamma oscillations. And these gamma oscillations are thought to measure the brain activity and are also suspected to be the backbone to mammalian consciousness, which I was really hoping, Steve, that you could talk a little bit about.
Well, I mean, I'll tell you basically what goes on. So brain function is a matter of lots of neurons firing together. You know, you don't imagine just like one little neuron firing and connecting to another neuron. There's also a lot of inherent background rhythms in the brain. The brainstem activating system and sends this like constant, you know, oscillation of activity to the cortex, to, like activating it. That's why there's something like alpha rhythm when you're in a relaxed state and your eyes are closed. There's this, you know, 14 hertz or so alpha rhythm going on in the background. And that's just the inherent background activity of your brain with lots of neurons firing together. Yeah, and it is thought that that is necessary for consciousness. This, you know, that you do need this sort of endless loop of these, you know, large groups of neurons firing in order for consciousness to be happening.
Yeah, I kind of think of it like, what do they call it, the gamma oscillations are like a computer that's pinging a million other computers on the web. Like there's a constant back and forth communication.
Well, gamma oscillations specifically, I mean, they're not really fully understood, but they appear to be due to local networks firing together, like a local network, maybe even paced by a single neuron, which is firing at its own frequency. It's not a distributed pattern of communication among the brain. At least that's what it seems to be at this point in time.
So in the test rats, the gamma oscillations were higher after cardiac arrest than when the animal was at a considered to be awake and healthy position, or, you know, place before they started the forced heart attack on the animal. So in other words, all the rats displayed a widespread momentary surge of highly synchronized brain activity that had features associated with a highly aroused brain while they were post heart attack.
Yeah.
One of the researchers said that it was feasible the same thing could happen in a human brain under similar circumstances and that these spikes could give rise to near-death visions. And here's a quote. This can give us a framework to begin to explain these. The fact that that they see light perhaps indicates the visual cortex in the brain is highly activated, and we have evidence to suggest this might be the case because we have seen increased gamma in areas of the brain that is right on top of the visual cortex.
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting study. It's just one small rat study, so you know it obviously need replication. We need to a little bit harder to do this in people. You have to just get lucky and you know be studying people who are at risk for having a heart attack.
Yeah, that's what they said. They were saying that in order to confirm that this is happening in humans, that they would have to be studying someone that's about to die and you know monitor them in the same way.
But there's a couple of things that come to mind in terms of this as an explanation for near-death experiences. It may be playing a role. I don't think it's the explanation for NDE. I agree with you, Jay. Obviously, I think NDEs are brain phenomena. So people often say that, people have this heightened awareness or out-of-body type experience. How could, while they were undergoing CPR, while their EEG was flat and could not possibly be generating any conscious effects. But the thing is, people are remembering this much later after they fully recovered enough to be conscious from the whole thing. They have no idea when that experience took place. It could have taken place, you know, in the moments after cardiac arrest started, but before their brain shut down when it went through this hyperactive phase. It could have occurred afterwards as they were slowly recovering. They have no way of placing that memory in time. There's no way for them to say that the memory occurred while their brain was flat, you know, while there was no EEG activity. The other thing, one other wrinkle to this. So this is assuming or taking the premise that the raw amount of brain activity correlates with the intensity of experiences of people. And that's not unreasonable, but it's also possible that decreased overall brain activity may result in increased or heightened experience because you're decreasing inhibitory parts of the brain. It's kind of like drugs that give you hallucinogenic experiences or heightened experiences, that they're doing that more by inhibiting parts of the brain that have a massive inhibitory effect, like your frontal lobes. Your frontal lobes, they are a complex, energy-hungry, slow, you know, processing that adds a lot of higher, you know, cortical function, advanced function, but it slows everything down and it has a huge inhibitory effect on more simple and primitive parts of the brain that might give you heightened experiences.
That's counterintuitive, though, isn't it?
Not if you understand how the nervous system works. It has a basic inhibitory function, you know. So that's often the case. And when you inhibit or decrease an inhibitory function, you get an increase in function. So that's basic kind of neuroscience.
Well, let me ask you a clarifying question. So are some parts of our brains or the functionality operating at a particular level, and that's the norm? When that thing is on, it's on at this level. And then instead of the brain dials that down instead of, it's not like lowering the volume, right? I'm trying to like visualize it. How do you see it? Like,
no,
what's
not
actually happening?
It's not really all or nothing. I mean, maybe some very specific circuits might be, it's either firing or not firing. But, for example, neurons tend to fire at a certain rate, right? A neuron's not on and off, on or off. A neuron is firing and that rate could go up or down. So that is like a volume, it very much so. You know, the rate at which the neuron is firing is increased or decreased. And then you have lots of networks that are all interacting with each other, and you're getting some net effect of all of that, both, you know, excitatory and inhibitory feedback and networks and connections. And there's some net effect of all of that. So, yeah, different parts of the brain, different networks can be functioning, operating at multiple different levels. It's not just like it's on or it's off.
NDEs, to me, seem like one of those phenomena where even if we do entirely have a grasp for it and have mapped it out front to beginning, we absolutely understand it scientifically, it will not stop people from believing that they're having some sort of out-of-body experience.
Yeah, I mean, like evolution, like pretty much anything. If there's a pre-existing sort of religious, mythological belief or cultural belief, yeah, the science is not going to make that go away for some people, you know?
For a lot of people.
Yeah.
Well, Jay, did any of the rats get booked for Oprah?
Well, three of them did, and three of them asked for too much, and they didn't let them on the show, unfortunately.
I look forward to that.
I imagine they're all dead.
Shut up. What?
Yeah,
no.
I thought about that.
How can they have near-death experiences if they're dead?
Yeah, I thought they'd have...
Yeah, I mean, Steve, how did they know what the rats experienced if they didn't bring them back and talk to them afterwards?
Yeah, that's true.
Like, did you see your dead grandmother? Etc.
All right. Well, Rebecca, let's, yes. let's shift gears a little bit. You're going to tell us why it's a great idea for all children to watch lots of television.
Yeah. Yeah. You should watch as much TV as possible. In fact, TV better than babysitters. Just plop your kid in front. Or maybe not. There is a study that is being reported on quite a bit that claims to show that TV, just an extra hour of TV beyond what is recommended by organizations like the American Academy for Pediatrics is enough to make your child stupid and bullied and, fat. I think that covers.
Are those technical terms, by the way?
No, those were not the terms used in the actual research. But yeah, according to a researcher at the University of Montreal named Professor Linda Pagani, they studied almost 2,000 kids whose parents reported on their television viewing habits from the time that they were very young. They had parents report on their kids' viewing habits from the time that they were very young, like pre-kindergarten up through kindergarten and beyond. And yeah, that's what they found, that more than 2 hours of TV viewing a day was enough for kids to have their grades suffer, to have them be less athletic, to have them be bullied, picked on by other children. And the researchers say that this is because TV, first of all, will make a child less likely to be going outside and running around and getting exercise, the kind of exercise they need to maintain a healthy weight and healthy lifestyle. And also, because TV is a solitary pursuit, children who engage in a lot of television watching are less likely to form social bonds and to learn how to get along with their peers, which the researchers say can then lead to them reacting poorly to other kids and not getting along well with them in school. So yeah, they are basing this on the parents self-reporting how much TV the kids watch and the kids' teachers filling out surveys on how the kids behaved. Now, it's kind of tough for me to give a lot of insight into this because the study has not even been published yet. But I did look at a previous study that shows pretty much the exact same stuff from the exact same researcher. It was published back in 2010 in the Archives of Pediatric Adolescent Medicine. So same researcher, Linda Pagani, Professor Linda Pagani and a few others published a study called Prospective Associations Between Early Childhood Television Exposure and Academic, Psychosocial, and Physical Well-being by Middle Childhood. And this study seemed to be almost exactly the same. There were about 1,300 kids studied in this one, and the same sort of stuff were looked at, like how much television are they watching and what are the results on their behavior?
Yeah, I wonder if they're trying to get two papers out of the same data set.
Hmm.
I don't know, because the it actually sounds like the numbers were slightly different, but
that
it was hard.
Matter. Same researchers, same methods. Got to be curious. I don't know.
Okay, because I was wondering, because I started out by doing a search to see what else this author had done, and I found articles in the popular press that had the exact same headlines as the present day ones. And so, yeah, okay. So in this study, at least, they did have some controls in place, because I know that a lot of you are probably thinking the same thing I'm thinking. Well, correlation, causation, you know.
Yeah.
But they did control for certain things that lend this study a bit more credence than I originally gave it. Things like they had parents start out by reporting on their children's behavior at the start of the study when they were very, very young in order to rule out the idea that behavioral problems were the cause of parents putting their kids in front of the TV, for instance. And those same behavior problems would later be reported on and seen by this study to be a result of being put in front of the TV when they existed beforehand. So they asked parents at the start to report on any behavioral problems from the time their kids were babies. They also controlled for gender to eliminate the idea that, for instance, like boys would be sat in front of the TV more often, things like that. So they did take into account several factors like that. It's still not by any means perfect and conclusive. I do think that there's plenty of chance that, you know, a kid could develop in some way to be both more antisocial and therefore want to just watch more TV. You know, it doesn't necessarily mean one follows from the other. I don't think their controls necessarily can completely rule that out as a possibility. And they also admit some variables that they weren't able to study that would have been better to study. So things like, what are these kids watching? Like, what's the quality of television? Are they just watching Saturday morning cartoons? Are they watching Sesame Street and other educational television? They don't distinguish in this study. Also, the reports done by the teachers were very broad, and there's a chance that the teachers weren't able to really tease out what these kids are like and what their real problems are or what they excel at. And also, they didn't test the kids' verbal and math scores to see if maybe watching television increases one but decreases the other. So there are some details that they weren't really able to go into in this study that presumably they will try to do in future studies, or maybe someone else will, hopefully.
Yeah, so I mean, I agree, Rebecca. I think, you know, evaluating a study like this, the weakness of these kind of observational studies where you're not randomizing kids, like subjects to exposure or not exposure or placebo or whatever. So like, we're not taking kids and saying, all right, we're going to force these kids to watch 2 hours, and we're going to force this other group of kids to watch 3 hours, and this other group to watch 4 hours, and they're randomized. Yeah. That's not happening. It's observational. So there's always the possibility that there's some intangible factor here. Like maybe parents who are bad parents in some other way also let their kids watch more television. And it's hard to control for every possible factor that could correlate with increased TV watching. Right. So it's not right. Just the arrow of cause and effect. There could be tons of other factors that could be influencing this. And it's just hard to make causal conclusions. I would really be too cautious about that. So how do we know from observational studies what a likely causal arrow is, you know, what the direction of causation is? And that's by, I think, triangulating multiple studies to see if it all consistently adds up to, yeah, you know, kids who watch more TV have increased problems. So I did review some of the recent literature on this question. The most recent other study I found by other researchers, this was published in 2013 in the Archives of Diseases of Childhood. They looked at 11,014 children. Similar study, you know, quantified TV watching, used the standard questionnaires for hyperactivity, pro-social behavior, relationship problems, et cetera, and they found that TV, but not electronic games, predicted a small increase in conduct problems, but not any other problem, not psychosocial adjustment, not relationships, none of these other things that this study that we're talking here showed. So very inconsistent with the current study. And then the most recent review I found in 2009, concluded this. This systematic review found insufficient, contradictory, and methodologically flawed evidence on the association between television viewing and video game playing and aggression in children and young people with behavioral and emotional difficulties. So not exactly the same question, but And just trying to dig through this research, it's actually a fairly large and complicated set of studies. It seems like that's what I'm seeing. There's a insufficient, contradictory evidence, mostly observational. You know, some showing that there's this effect, some showing a different effect, some showing no effect. So I don't think we can make any firm conclusions at this point is the bottom line.
Yeah, I agree. And what I took from this is basically the advice that I think makes most sense in pretty much every situation, which is don't do too much of a thing.
Yeah. Common sense, I think, just still holds. Yeah, moderation. parents should have some, you know, get out of, I tell my kids, okay, all right, you've had enough TV watching for today. Get out of the house and do something else.
Right.
And, but, just, and that's just common sense.
And I think it's fine to ignore the more headline grabbing news that, oh, more than 1 hour a day or more than 2 hours a day and your child is ruined.
Yeah. Right.
You know, I,
as if that's going to make a huge,
going a little far.
Yeah.
I also agree the type of television makes a huge difference. If my kids are watching something educational, let them alone. I don't care educational TV they watch, honestly. So it's really just when they're just vegging in front of cartoons where I say, all right, let's do something else. You know, this is just.
What about the social interaction element, though, Steve?
There, you know, at least in the most recent studies I found, didn't seem to be in effect. So I don't know what to say. If you assume there is a correlation there, it could make sense of it either way. Kids who are less social will tend towards activities which are less social, like TV watching. But also, they get into a comfort zone, you know, entertaining themselves with video type of entertainment, and therefore they're not pushed to form social skills.
There's less available time.
Yeah, you could make sense of it either way, and I don't think the data separates those two out. We are going to go on to another study, and again, this is a similar situation where you have an observational study, you know, reported in the media as showing some cause and effect when really you can't get that from the data. This one was found an association between autism and induced labor, or what they're saying, induced versus augmented labor. Meaning using some medication like Pitocin to try to get women who are not progressing or who are late to start to deliver their child. They found that children who were born as a result of a labor that was either induced or augmented had a higher risk of having autism, especially among males, which, you know, more males are more susceptible to autism than females. So that kind of makes sense. Okay. So you have an observational study like this showing correlation between A and B. The first question is the correlation itself real, reliable, or is it an artifact? Is it weak? Is the data rigorous enough? So this looks like a pretty rigorous study. The authors looked at 625,000 live births, including 5,500 children with a diagnosis of autism. And the methodology seems pretty good. I'm not a statistician, so that's like the one thing I have to just rely upon them, that they did the stats right. But it looks like the methods were fairly reasonable. They also tried to control for known factors that might affect it, like, for example, socioeconomic status. Again, you could think that there's a lot of third factors that may make it more likely, you know, to get a diagnosis of autism and also have procedures during delivery. They tried to control for those things. So if we take as a plausible conclusion of this study that there's an actual association between autism and induced labor, we are left with the generic interpretations of that. Does inducing labor actually trigger autism to some extent in some individuals? Or do autistic kids, are they more likely to require induced or augmented labor because they don't move as well or whatever, something is different, or maybe their head's bigger? There's multiple factors that people have thought of. Or is there some third thing? Does the environment of the womb both increase the risk of needing induced labor and also increase the risk of developing autism? This data doesn't answer that for us. It just shows that there's a correlation. But what's interesting is that a lot of the news outlets reported this study and they chose one or the other interpretation as if that's what the study showed. So a lot of them said, the study shows that autism is present even in the womb. And another paper said, study shows that inducing labor causes autism. And they're both wrong in the opposite direction. The study shows a correlation and you really can't make any kind of causal conclusion from the mere correlation alone. And it's, you know, there hasn't been enough of this research into this question to really infer or triangulate to what the likely causal direction is. It is interesting, though, I do think that of the three possibilities, that autism may increase the risk of delayed delivery, or that there's some womb environment factor that's both increasing the risk of developing autism and also increasing the risk of delaying delivery and requiring induction. Those are, I think, the more plausible explanations.
How do doctors induce labor, Steve?
Mainly with medication, Pitocin, which is oxytocin. If that's the case, though, if this is a sign that autism changes in the brain are present in the womb, of course, that scuttles any notion that autism is significantly caused by any environmental trigger after delivery, like vaccines. Again, this study does not prove that autism is present in the womb or that vaccines are not associated with it. It's just, it is consistent with that, though, at least the likely interpretations of the data.
Why do you think it's more likely that it's present in the womb and not a result of drugs?
So we do know that autism is highly genetic. There's many genes that are associated with autism. Although we also know that genes are not everything because there's only about a 50% identical twin concordance with autism. We also know that autism is present very early in clinically. So pretty much as early as you would expect to be able, you know, when kids are doing stuff, you know, their brains develop to the point where they're doing anything, we could see the earliest signs of autism at about 6 months. And we also know that the kind of problems with autism in terms of brain organization, children with autism have more brain cells, but those brain cells are not connected to each other very well, especially the two hemispheres. The two halves of the brain do not communicate very well. So that may simply be that because there's so many neurons, they just don't have the mechanism to network with each other adequately. So you get lots of poorly connected neurons. That kind of development takes place in the womb. You know, it's not the kind of thing that would happen right at delivery. It's also, you know, that one brief exposure right during delivery. It just doesn't seem very plausible that would, you know, trigger such profound changes in brain development where, you know, probably something that has been occurring throughout, you know, the fetal development in the womb. It makes more sense that it has something to do with genetics and the environment of the womb itself. So just from a basic neuroscience point of view of how the brain develops and the kind of problems we know are present in autism, I think that's why those are the more plausible explanations.
Thank you for that very thorough answer.
Yeah, but but it obviously needs to be studied. You know, we definitely want all of our ducks in a row here, and obviously this is the kind of research that would give us more insight into all the various contributing factors to autism and then maybe even what to do about it. But, you know, we'll have to wait and see. All right. This was going to be Bob's quickie if he were here. So we've been following the discovery of exoplanets, which is just one of the coolest developments in astronomy and science in the last decade or so. The fact that the methods that were being talked about in the 80s finally got implemented and they're freaking working and we're discovering all these exoplanets. One method is called the direct observation method, where you actually directly view the planet, but first you have to eliminate the glare from its parent star. This is done using a technique called a coronagraph. The planet is imaged in infrared or near-infrared spectrum because that's where it tends to be the brightest, and the direct light of the sun is masked or subtracted out from the image. This one was done at the Mauna Kea telescope in Hawaii. So because it was an Earth-based telescope, they also had to use adaptive optics to eliminate the smearing effect from atmospheric distortion. But this allows for an image of the planet itself. So far, you know, we've discovered large Jupiter-like planets with this method. Recently, we've discovered another one, GJ504b. And what's cool about this planet is that because we directly observed it, we could actually measure the spectra of light that comes from it, and the planet has a dark magenta color. So imagine Jupiter, but the color of, as they say, a dark cherry blossom, a dull magenta color. The artist's conception of this planet are just gorgeous, and I'm sure the planet itself is probably 100 times prettier if we could see it.
Now we're sure about this. This is actually magenta in color. If we were to be near it, that is exactly what we'd see. It's not an interpretation of some data set.
No, I don't think so. I mean, you know, this is a direct observation, so we're actually getting light directly from the planet, and they could measure its spectrum. So unless they're missing something, you know, I don't know. So this is interesting in a number of other ways as well. The planet is several times the mass of Jupiter. However, it is the lowest mass planet ever detected around a star like the sun using the direct imaging method. So again, that method tends to view only very big planets. It's also extremely far from its parent star, 9 times further than is Jupiter. And this is so far away from the star that it's actually challenging our models of planet formation. We're not sure how a planet could have gotten that big, that far from its star. So it's
rogue,
interesting.
Rogue, yeah. Maybe a rogue planet that captured at some point?
I thought of that too. Yeah, maybe it was a rogue planet or something else. Something else is going on in this solar system that is puzzling astronomers. So
how far away is it from the Earth?
57 light years. So cool. So maybe we'll have a picture of that on our notes.
Pretty.
All right, Evan, you're going to finish up the news items for us by telling us about this poor, unfortunate baby that the press is saying is the victim of spontaneous human combustion.
Yeah, there's a lot of fail going around with this particular story on the part of news, on the part of doctors, lots of people all over the place getting this one wrong. It was reported that a baby born in India is the victim of a condition doctors are calling spontaneous human combustion. I didn't know this was a medical condition that appeared in any sort of medical books. Are you aware? Does this appear in any medical books that you've ever read, Steve?
No, it's ridiculous. So they're calling it a rare medical condition. What? No, it's an imaginary condition is what it is.
A 3-month-old baby bursts into flames when he sweats. A 3-month-old boy who allegedly suffers from a rare condition where he bursts into flames every time he sweats is in a hospital recovering from his injuries. This is my first experience seeing anywhere where spontaneous human combustion has been and sweat have been captured together in the same story.
Yeah.
Typically, when we talk about spontaneous human combustion stories or reports, it's usually older people who are alone and either have some source of an open flame near them, whether it's a fireplace or they're smoking a cigarette while they're sitting in their easy chair at home and they're alone, and unfortunate accidents can happen in those situations. And
it's always people who
die. End result is.
Like, it's never this kid is alive?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, like, I've never heard of another case where
There are a few people who have survived alleged cases of human combustion, and they say that they just burst into flames. But, you know, they were standing in front of an open flame, you know, or whatever. Right. There's always a plausible external source of flame. They just could have landed on their clothes or whatever.
But it's not just one time this has happened to this baby. Apparently, it's happened 4 times in this young child's very, very short life so far. Knowing what we know of spontaneous human combustion, that it is a phenomenon that has no plausibility. There's no scientific evidence whatsoever showing that anything like this actually exists in nature. You have to wonder, well, what is actually going on here? And unfortunately, the options are very disturbing as far as I'm concerned.
So what are the other theories then?
Well,
child abuse.
Yeah, I mean, the only other plausible theory is that there's some form of child abuse going on here. Unless there was just some source of flame in the house that the parents weren't, like, near the crib or something that they weren't aware of.
I did find
one news report. This is znews.india.com. Mm-hmm, this, I think, is a more recent report, like a day later.
A few days later.
Yeah, did you find this one, Evan?
I did, yes.
Yeah, so they did say that there was blood work, which was normal, you know, shocker, and that they do say this: doctors are divided on their opinion about the rare medical condition, with some stating that it is a possibility and others completely rejecting it as a hoax. Ding, 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 ding. I mean, there is a video of one of the doctors there talking about SHC as if it's a genuine rare medical condition and talking about the sweat. They're just making that up. There's absolutely no data about that whatsoever. But also, I'm sure there's a massive journalism filter in here. Just, I agree. I think it's a fail between the doctors and the journalists. Although apparently there are some doctors there who are A, not ruling out that this is abuse, and B, understand that SHC is a hoax. I wonder what that interaction is like, you know, the fight among the doctors who are involved with this case.
one of the head of pediatrics at the department of the hospital where the baby was taken says, and this is a quote, "The body burns spontaneously due to combustible gases emitting from the patient's body without any external source of ignition. Clothes and other things nearby are inflammable, also may catch fire." This is the head of pediatrics at this facility.
Yeah.
So very disturbing.
Is this gas supposed to be coming out of the skin?
And we have two different, one article says it's sweat, another one says it's gas. Like Steve said, I think they're just making this up. Whatever they can think of at the moment.
It's as if they can't conceive that this is child abuse, so they're just riffing, trying to figure out what could possibly be doing this.
You know, a third possibility is that this entire thing is a very complex hoax. That this hospital doesn't even exist. These aren't real doctors. That's what I'm going to hope for, because it's better than the idea.
I don't know. There are pictures and video. Usually with the hoaxes, you don't get that.
Yeah. Well, what Rebecca's saying is she's hoping
pictures and video.
It's the Homer Simpson answer where, okay, I'm just going to go hide in the closet under some coats and hope it all goes away.
Yeah.
So there was a little tidbit here, Adam, and I don't know if you noticed this, but all of the, the several of the news reports that I read mentioned that the baby suffered, quote, 10 degree burns.
I was thinking they must have a different scale, perhaps
like
in
degree?
India.
Yeah, 10 degree burns. So I don't know what that means. I looked it up. I couldn't find anything. I found the Urban Dictionary has 10 degree burn. They define a 10th degree burn as a burn so severe that your body starts to change into that of a robot.
Oh, what? Wow.
I guess like Terminator or something.
Great.
Yeah.
Yes.
That was
right down to your metal skeleton.
The only definition I could find of 10th degree burn. So if this is a scale in India, I would like to hear about it, because I only know up to 4th degree burns. I hope we get some follow through. And if we have any listeners in India and this, sort of drops out of the international news, but the local news continues to report it, please keep us updated. I want to know if there's any conclusion to this, like, one of the parents getting arrested or something like that. But Rebecca, there's a Facebook page.
Yes.
The 35 best times someone on Facebook thought the Onion was real. Yeah. Yes. The Onion, of course, is a fake, satirical news, newspaper, now online news outlet. They publish brilliant stories that just cut right to the bone of some, popular culture idiocy. But they are so over the top. I mean, most of the time you read them and you laugh at the headline because it's just so ridiculous. Here's one like, Obama finishes deal to get every American a free parrot.
I want my free parrot.
Oh, I like this one. Lonely teacher, outcast student begins somewhat endearing sexual relationship. But the reason why we're talking about this is because of this one. Scientists trace heat wave to massive star at the center of solar system.
Who knew?
Yes. But what could it be?
What could it be? But the thing is, so the page that I was going over, like people, the Onion, I looked at the article on the Onion, they don't have comments, but people post the article on their Facebook page and then people leave comments underneath the article. So like some of the comments were, oh my goodness, that's crazy, or freaking awesome, I can't believe I got this. Another one, my favorite is, that is insane. It's like something out of Star Wars.
The one about I got this is my favorite because the guy took a photo of a fire or something. And it looks like there are two suns in the sky. And so he thought that he actually photographed the star at the center of the galaxy or whatever.
Yeah.
Causing the heat wave. Like, that's what he thought.
Or did he actually take a photograph of the sun and this is some sort of flaring lens effect that it's actually just capturing a little
what
looks like a little piece of the sun?
He didn't take a photo of two suns in the sky. I'm saying
no, I understand
that. He took a photo where there are two bright spots and he thinks that he captured our sun. And
plus
the galaxy sun.
Yeah.
Well,
the galactic sun.
There's no mention anywhere in the article or the headline about a star at the center of the galaxy or a galaxy sun. Just one person just substituted galaxy for solar system, I think because they don't understand the difference.
Right.
It's like that cartoon. I can't remember what it was, but it's like, together with the other whatever planets of the galaxy, they you toured the solar system to protect the universe from. It's like they just completely mix solar system, universe, galaxy together as if they're all the same thing. So yeah, you wonder like how many people like just didn't recognize that our sun is the star at the center of the solar system, and some how many people just don't realize what a solar system is. Like the difference between a solar system and a galaxy.
It also, it reminded me of when I was in eighth grade, I remember my science teacher giving us a quiz and one of the questions was, what's the nearest star to planet Earth? And I have to say that I got it wrong.
Yeah, but that's a trick question.
I was so excited.
Did you actually know the second closest one, Rebecca?
Well, I was thinking, I think, what did I put? I think I put
Alpha Centauri.
Is it? I thought it was the one in Lyra.
It's Proxima Centauri, technically, yeah. But
technically,
yeah. I mean, yeah. So, yeah. Some people may not realize that our sun is a star, but also you may just think that you may interpret the question as the closest star to our system. You know, and not because it could kind of trick you that way.
No, it was just not thinking of the sun as a star.
Okay.
And I think that's why it was a good quiz because ever since then, I do.
You were embarrassed into understanding that.
Yes.
Okay. It's one way to do it.
And it's not that we didn't know that the sun was a star. It's just that you put it in a separate category because of your relationship to it.
Exactly.
Yeah. So close and all.
Right.
Rather cozy.
I was a little disappointed in that list of the best times people thought the onion was real because they didn't include what I think is the all-time greatest, which was years ago, the Onion had an article about Harry Potter and kids learning, like reading Harry Potter in school and giving up Christianity. And they had quotes from the kids saying things like, Harry Potter taught me that Jesus died because he was weak and stupid. And fundamentalist Christians just exploded over it. And it was the subject of like a number of pundits complaining that Harry Potter should not be taught in schools.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Hey, did you know 85% of Americans don't know all the dance moves to the national anthem?
Reading through the list too, anything about Obama people believe. If you hate Obama and they can say anything.
Oh, like
my favorite one here is that President Obama personally performs the first Obamacare euthanasia.
Now come on.
Gotta love it. All right, Evan, who's that noisy time?
Yeah, let's play for you last week's Who's That Noisy?
If it disagrees with experiment, it's wrong. And that simple statement is the key to science.
And who was that wise man?
Yes, extremely wise man. No, it was not Richard Wiseman. That was, in fact, Richard Feynman.
Ah, he's an extremely fine man.
One of the best.
Extremely fine man. Tremendous, tremendous. And he had a series many, many moons ago in which he, a television series, in which he talked about, well, science and tried to explain some of the rudimentary basics of science to the audience. So I wish there was more of that going on, frankly.
Yeah.
He did it in such a way. I mean, it was absolutely characteristically him.
Yeah, it's like such a New Yorker. If it disagrees with experiment, it's wrong. You know, there you go. There's your science.
You're almost channeling Perry in a way from the future. And he was, of course, an American theoretical physicist known for his work in the path of integral formulation of quantum mechanics and the theory of quantum electrodynamics and the physics of superfluidity, amongst many other things. And yes, Nobel Prize recipient for physics in 1965. Well-deserved.
Who
and
got
popularizer
it?
Of science. And a lot of people got it. Lots of people got it. Thank goodness.
Oh, yeah.
That's a very good sign.
That was an easy one.
But we can only have one winner each week. There can be only one. Rob S., your name was drawn this week. You are this week's winner. Congratulations.
Congrats.
Congrats.
You got something for us this week?
I do. I have a puzzle this week. This has been to date, and I think I can say with some assurance, the shortest puzzle I'll ever come up with. It's a sequence puzzle, so I'd like you to finish the sequence, please. Here you go. G, 4, E, 5.
Bingo.
F, 3. one more time. G, 4, E5F3. And now finish the sequence for me. And there is a finishing finish to the sequence.
Excellent.
I look on the message boards. I might, if I'm feeling generous on Saturday morning, I might give a little hint there. And you can find that at our forums, sguforums.com, or go ahead and give it your best guess. Send us an email at WTN, which stands for Who's That Noisy, by the way, WTN@theskepticsguide.org. And as I say every week, good luck, everyone.
All right. Thank you, Evan. All right. One more question. This is actually a name that logical fallacy.
Woohoo.
This is from the comment to, this is from a comment that was posted today on Science-Based Medicine.
Mm-hmm.
The person wrote, clinical observation by experienced practitioners with a discerning mind frequently occurs decades before the sheep mentality of specific collective academic fraternities is able to satisfy itself with these new theories.
Wow.
Wow. Yeah. That's quite a, it's quite a thought or
it's going to take me 10 minutes just to parse that.
Right.
What is that one giant non sequitur?
Well, yeah, all logical fallacies are non sequiturs, but yes, it is.
Sure,
but would you get more specific?
Well, it's a $500 sentence to start off with.
That's true.
Let me read it again. So what they're saying is, so this is on a post that I wrote a couple weeks ago on Erlen syndrome, which is a controversial idea that certain types of cognitive and reading disorders are actually due to problems with the way the brain processes certain frequencies of light. And you can fix it by giving people colored lenses that filter out the problematic frequencies of light. This has been a notion for 40 years. And still, where have we seen this before? The proponents have never managed to do compelling, rigorous scientific research to prove even their basic principles, let alone that their interventions are effective. So this is a classic pseudoscience. If they really believe that they're onto something here, do some frickin' studies and prove it. That's, mm-hmm. that's the point. I can't tell you that this is impossible. It's a little far-fetched, but it's, you know, it's a physical thing. And yeah, it all has to do with how the brain processes information, but they went right from the basic idea to, you know, the whole infrastructure of practice without actually going through the pesky hard work of doing the science and convincing the scientific community that their ideas are correct. There's also lots of reasons to suspect that there's lots of diagnostic substitution going on here that they're, with the features that they're claiming support that this diagnosis are actually features of other known, you know, ophthalmological diseases or disorders. And therefore that the concept doesn't add anything unique or necessary to the understanding of these issues, of these problems, of visual problems. So anyway, in the comments to this article, someone wrote, clinical observation by experienced practitioners with a discerning mind frequently occurred decades before the sheep mentality of specific collective academic fraternities is able to satisfy itself with these new theories. Let me translate that to you.
Please.
Gurus often know what's right long before you stuffed shirt scientists convince yourselves with actual scientific research that it's correct.
Okay, now I get it.
Yeah.
Much cleaner way of saying it.
The core informal logical fallacy here is the lottery fallacy, in that they're looking at only situations in which somebody has an idea that they're championing, and then decades later, scientists finally prove that it's correct. And then and only then do they adopt it, or according to the commenter, satisfy itself with these new theories. So that's like saying, I wrote a comment to this saying, oh, well, according to that logic, I should just go to the lottery commission and say, hey, I want my millions of dollars. You know, people win all the time. You know, why bother actually, you know, going through the trouble of picking the numbers? You know, someone's going to win, just give me the money. We have to go through the bother of actually picking the numbers because there are hundreds of theories that people are espousing before there's scientific evidence. You know, for every one that turns out to have been correct, there are, you know, how many score? Hundreds that turn out not to be correct. And how do we know the difference? We know the difference by doing the rigorous science. That's how we pick that one out from all the ones that are incorrect. There's also lots of evidence, in fact, a recent study that was published about a couple months ago, that show that if anything, we adopt new treatments way too soon. We're jumping the gun too much. We should actually be taking more time before we adopt new treatments in medicine. Because, you know, most of the stuff that we're, the new treatments that we're using turn out not to work.
But that's not the way modern society works, Steve. People want it now, now, now. They don't want to wait. They don't want to spend 10, 20, 30 years waiting for the studies to pan out.
Too bad.
They want their new fangled fixes right now.
But in this, it's also the practitioners want to make a living doing their new treatment without having to be bothered to do the science to prove that it actually works.
They just want, yeah, they just want to make money and also play the role of the you know, medical hero.
Yeah.
Did you ever notice that about chiropractors, by the way? Because I've been to several chiropractors, like, you know, a long time ago. They always have like this kind of hero attitude, from my observation.
I mean, it's easy for any healing professional to fall into. And, you know, especially if you convince yourself that you have access to secret knowledge or skill that most other practitioners don't have. You know, it's like everyone thinks they're good in the sack, right? It's like every practitioner thinks they have something unique or special to offer. Not all of them are true. Everyone thinks they're a good driver. But we all know that that's not true, because we all know there's a lot of crappy drivers out there on the street.
So true.
Yeah, I don't know if it's – it could just be that, just that generic phenomenon you know, thrown in, that you actually do have an expertise, you know, and a body of knowledge. And I do think that with alternative medicine, you get into the guru effect, where it's not just, you know, this humbling, hard-won scientific knowledge, but you have like this secret mystical knowledge.
Steve, is that your best guess as to what you think he was actually trying to say with this sentence?
Because oh, there's no question that's what they're saying. I'm pulling this out of a conversation, so I know exactly what they were saying. They're saying, you know, you're rejecting this because big pharma, they're invoking a lot of conspiracy fallacies as well. It's like, oh yeah, what, I'm going to believe studies that are funded by big pharma and done by these closed-minded academic stuff shirts. You can't see the forest for the trees. No, I'm going to believe the guy who's actually helping people, you know, typical nonsense.
Uses the term sheep mentality. So yeah. He's throwing an insult in there.
Oh, it's, I mean, the whole thing is just, it's also an ad hominem throughout. And then there's an implied argument from false authority in there as well. The experienced practitioners. Well, experienced practitioners can't tell you what works and what doesn't work. That the experience is actually greatly misleading. So it's an ad hominem, argument from authority, and lottery fallacy kind of rolled into one. Very nice. They also had a long back and forth on being open-minded, which always strikes me as profoundly ironic, because the people who are most often making the accusation of being open-minded are the most closed-minded people on the planet. And they're often accusing the most open-minded people on the planet, scientists, of being closed-minded.
I don't think they know what the term really means.
No, they use it as just a blanket dismissal.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious, and I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake-a-rooney. You guys all ready for this week?
Oh, yeah. We accept right. Your challenge.
We have a tricky theme this week. The theme is skeptical principles.
All right.
Okay.
And what's a little tricky about it is that what makes the item the fiction is not that the statement is not true. It's that there wasn't a recent study showing that it's true. So these are three skeptical principles. Two of which there actually was a study showing empirically that what skeptics have been saying for a long time is actually true, whereas the other one, I could not find any study or empirical evidence to show that it's true. Doesn't mean it's wrong, though. Doesn't mean it's wrong. You'll understand when I read them.
Yeah.
Okay? All right, here we go. Uh-huh. Item number one, a new study finds that medical testimonials that contain irrelevant information may lead to inappropriate medical decision-making. Item number two, a recent study finds that listening to an emotional sermon can induce an out-of-body experience in susceptible people. And item number three, a new paper warns against chemophobia, the irrational fear of the ubiquitous and non-toxic chemicals found in our food and environment. Jay, go first.
So the first one about the medical testimonies that contain irrelevant information. Steve, who's making the testimony? It's someone that received the procedure?
A testimonial. I took this treatment. It worked for me. And then somebody else reading that makes a bad decision based upon a testimonial.
Right. I could see a testimonial being vague or in some way misleading to confuse someone. So I think that one is science. Yeah, this other one about listening to an emotional sermon and it leading to some type of out-of-body experience, as huge as that may sound or as profound as that may sound, I do have some information about people that were at a concert or experiencing some type of event where they had a phenomenally huge emotional response to it. So I'm going to extrapolate a little bit and actually think that this one is plausible as well. And okay, and this final one about chemophobia. I'm going to say that out of the three of these, I think the first one, the one about the medical testimonials, is the fake.
Okay, Evan?
We talk so much about testimonials in the context of what level or quality of evidence they represent. We explain to people that they are, in effect, worthless in scientific analysis. And then the one about listening to an emotional sermon inducing an out-of-body experience. I seem that this one seems to be the have sort of the broadest parameters of the three. An emotional sermon to someone, you know, that's very wide. Same sermon is very emotional to some, not as to others. And then an out-of-body experience, that's also can be interpreted very widely. So I'm tending to think that's the widest net, and therefore that one's going to wind up being science. The last one, chemophobia, leaning towards that one. Yeah, I guess got to choose. I will say chemophobia. That one is the fiction in this particular context.
Okay, and Rebecca.
Okay, so that's the one that I find most believable, just because I'm thinking about it in terms of, since all of these are obviously going to be plausible, I'm thinking about it in terms of what is most ripe for somebody to study. And I think that the chemophobia one is like right up there for like easy publishing for any psych student that wants to get published.
It's what they want you to think.
Yeah, but I don't know. I completely buy that. And along the same lines, I would find it relatively simple to design a study on medical testimonials that would determine whether or not someone reading that testimonial would walk away with the wrong idea about what medical decision to make. But studying whether or not an emotional sermon can induce an out-of-body experience, that would be much more difficult. Like, I could see that resulting in maybe a case study, maybe just a look at various people's reported experiences. But I can't imagine them hooking somebody up to like an fMRI and having a pastor preach to them and watching what happens. And even if they did do that, then I don't think they would call it an out-of-body experience. I think they would say, you know, that it resulted in an interesting change in brain patterns, blah, blah, blah. So I think that for those reasons, I'm going to go with the sermon one as being the fake.
All right, so we got an even split. You guys are all over the place. That's excellent. So I might as well take these in order. Number one, a new study finds that medical testimonials that contain irrelevant information may lead to inappropriate medical decision-making. Jay, you think this one is the fiction?
Uh-oh.
And this one is...
Could be.
Science. Sorry,
Hooray.
Jay.
Okay.
One down.
Yeah, so what they did was they showed testimonials. They made up a fake disease, and they gave case histories to subjects with clear information about like what they're, you know, with the information that they were given, there really was one clear best way to go. And then they gave them testimonials about patients who used it. And what they found was that when the testimonial, and this was the testimonial included like somebody recommending to them that they take a certain treatment for this fake illness, when they included irrelevant information in the testimonial, that it increased the subject reading that information making bad healthcare decisions, especially when that irrelevant information made some kind of connection between the patient and the person giving the advice. So, for example, if they like both liked baseball, that had absolutely nothing to do with anything to do with the disease, but that they had a personal connection that made the testimonial itself seem more plausible and had more impact on subjects, even though it was completely irrelevant information. And this is showing what we've said for a long time. Personal stories are very compelling. You know, these kind of personal connections, personal aspects of these are very compelling, but they have absolutely nothing to do with scientific questions, medical questions, does a treatment work or not, but it does lead people astray. Number two, a recent study finds that listening to an emotional sermon can induce an out-of-body experience in susceptible people. Rebecca, you think this one is fiction. The other two of you think this one is science. And this one is the fiction.
Ah, good job, Rebecca.
Wow.
Good work, Rebecca.
Thank you.
So, yeah, I made this one up. But this
made
was
up.
The true study is a new study of out-of-body experience. Now, you know, researchers have been able to induce out-of-body experiences, the sensation that you are located somewhere else, either that you're just outside of your body or that you're actually occupying some other physical space or even another like virtual avatar, that they can induce this in many ways using virtual reality or essentially or tricking your sensory feedback. So essentially what the brain actively constructs the sensation that you're in your body by comparing your bodily sensations to what you see, to what you feel. And when you can trick people into having the brain construct your where you are somewhere else. The recent study that I was basing this on, they added one more kind of way to trick the brain into having an out-of-body experience. What they did was that they had a visual, you know, subjects with wearing virtual reality goggles, and they showed them a virtual body, and then they had a recording of their heartbeat. And they had a display showing the heartbeat in sync with their own heartbeat in the virtual person. And a certain percentage of people, you know, felt that they were located closer to or that they were located in that virtual body. It actually changed the way their brain constructed their location, their sense of self. So just added the physical sensations about your bodily functions, like your heartbeat, to the list of things that the brain uses to construct its sense of that you occupy your physical body. Now, I tried to say, okay, I'm going to come up with something else, you know, something else inducing an out-of-body experience, but it was hard for me to find something that there wasn't some study somewhere showing that it, you know, it
we're
induces an
out-of-body.
We're just
right about so many things.
Experience. You know, there's, you know, I was thinking belief, it correlates with belief in ghosts, with belief in ESP. I just couldn't find something that didn't correlate with that we would think. So then I hit upon this and I couldn't find anything about it. There certainly aren't any studies, you know, anything recently published showing that a sermon makes you have an out-of-body experience. Again, I'm not saying that's wrong. I'm just saying I couldn't find a study showing that it specifically happens. All right, let's go on. Number three, a new paper warns against chemophobia, the irrational fear of the ubiquitous and non-toxic chemicals found in our food and environment. And that one, of course, is science. This was actually not published by a psychologist, but by a chemistry professor whose name is Gordon Gribble. What an awesome name, Gordon Gribble.
That's a good name.
Yeah. Published a paper in the journal Food Security. And he argues that low doses of chemicals in modern food are inherent, typically harmless, and often highly beneficial. However, there are a lot of people who are fearful and avoidant of anything that they consider to be a quote-unquote chemical, not aware of the fact that they're everywhere. This is also the naturalistic fallacy, right? The notion that that chemicals are inherently unnatural and poisonous or toxic, not realizing that there's a lot of natural chemicals out there and you breathe them in, they're in your food, they're everywhere. He calls this chemophobia and was warning against this. It's a manifestation of scientific illiteracy. There's not of chemical illiteracy specifically. He's a chemist, so that makes sense. He argues that a lot of the chemophobia started in 1962 with the publication of Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring. We've talked about that a little bit before on the show. You guys remember that?
Yeah.
Reinforced
public fear about major chemical accidents. And he said that, whenever there's a chemical spill or accident, that makes the front page news. However, when later research finds that it never actually caused any problems, that doesn't get reported and nobody finds out about it. So a lot of famous chemical spills or exposures or environmental hazards or whatever turned out to be nothing. But, there still are sort of these iconic, you know, stories that everybody knows about the dangers of chemicals. So good work, Rebecca.
Thank you.
Very nice.
Yeah. Good job sniffing that one.
Nice job.
All right. Well, Jay, do you have a quote for us?
I do. I have a quote taken from a place I've never gotten a quote from before. This is a commenter on science-based medicine, William Lawrence Uttridge.
Uttridge.
I just can't win with pronouncing things. It's just my decisions I make are always wrong. The quote is, and brace yourself, this is a long one. It's funny when people accuse science of being narrow merely because it asks for proof. Science expanded the number of elements from 4 to over 100. It expanded treatment options for bloodletting, herbs, and purgatives to the untold riches we have today. It expanded the universe from a series of armillary spheres to the current night-endless void. It expanded the number of worlds from 2 to billions upon billions. It expanded the age of the universe from 7,000 to 13.5 billion. Science expanded our senses from a tiny range of sound and light to an endless modulation of wavelengths, revealing whole worlds we knew nothing about. It extended our senses from millimeters to angstroms, from kilometers to light years. Science discovered volcanoes under the oceans, terrible lizards who ruled our murine predecessors, asteroids that shattered the world, glaciers that circled the globe, the origins of man and ape rather than God. Science exposed the lie of vitalism, extended lives, cured cancer, discovered vitamins, discovered radiation, then found it was bad for us. And in the last group of discoveries, quacks were poised to kill the discoveries and loot their corpses. Yes, that's really serious. It's dead serious and spot on.
Yeah, very good. You know, this, because we get this so often, the gurus and their apologists keep saying, oh, you scientists are so limited and closed-minded and narrow. You have your little narrow little worldview. Meanwhile, science has expanded the human, you know, conceptual repertoire massively over the last couple hundred years. And this is just, he gives us a little whirlwind tour of many of the ways in which science has broadened our horizons and opened our view. And yet the gurus want to make it sound like they're the ones, you know, who have the vision, because they're parroting mystical nonsense from thousands of years ago or some endless nonsensical variation on them. So this was a wonderful smackdown. I just had to use it.
It's always the pseudoscience that uses the new language of science, right? So quantum is a perfect example. Mm-hmm. Like, they don't come up with their own quantum. I once asked a chiropractor, so tell me, what advances has chiropractic made, say, in the past 25 years? Because I'll give you a long list of things that modern medicine has come up with.
You
know,
right.
Guy's jaw, you know, his bottom jaw hit the table when I said that. Right. Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. The next time.
They try to turn it around and say, well, scientists don't know anything because their claims are always changing. You know, they could twist anything onto its head.
You bastard. Excellent quote. Excellent quote.
Well done.
It was worth the length. Yep. I agree. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks, Doc.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.